Welcome to Micro, I'm Drew Hawkins, and this episode is part of an interview series for Miami Book Fair, where members of Team Micro, that's myself, Dylan Evers, Maymay Kaufman, and Kirsten Renault, interview authors appearing at the fair about their work. For more information about their programming and to check out the incredible roster of authors appearing this year, visit miamibookfair.com. And be sure to follow them at Miami Book Fair and hashtag Miami Book Fair 2022 for more updates. Now, back to the show. Welcome to Micro. I'm Drew Hawkins. And today I'm speaking with writer, producer, scholar of religions, Reza Aslan. We'll be talking about his new book, An American Martyr in Persia, The Epic Life and Tragic Death of Howard Baskerville, which will be published in October by W.W. Norton & Company. And to start the show, we've asked him to select and read a passage from the book. So here's Reza Aslan reading the opening of the introduction. Enjoy.
I have always known the name Howard Baskerville. For as long as I can remember, his name was a flash in the corner of my eye. When I was a child growing up in Iran, there were schools named after him. His face, cast in bronze, was prominently displayed in a museum in Tabriz, the city in which he died and was buried. His tomb is still there, pressed up against an overgrown apricot tree in a long abandoned cemetery. The edges of the sarcophagus are smooth and worn, not from the elements, but from a century or so of curious hands. People used to come here from all over the country to honor the American who gave his life for Iran. These days, hardly anyone comes at all. Those few who still visit his tomb know little about the man lying inside, save for the bare facts of his life and death. He was 22 years old, a Christian missionary. He came to Persia in the fall of 1907 to teach English and history and to preach the gospel. He took up arms and fought alongside his students in a bloody revolution against a ruthless tyrant. He died a martyr in the cause of freedom and democracy.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I guess my first question would be, can you briefly tell us who Howard Baskerville is and, you know, what his significance is or was in Iran?
You know, Baskerville was the son and grandson of Presbyterian preachers from the Black Hills of South Dakota. He had an incredible experience when he went to Princeton in order to study Christian theology, is that he happened to take a couple of classes with the president of the time of the university, Woodrow Wilson. And Wilson gave him this notion of democracy as a kind of divine gift, that it was essentially the birthright of all humans everywhere. And so when he graduated, rather than go back to South Dakota, where his parents were, and to take up a position as a country pastor, he decided instead to go on an adventure. He applied to become a Christian missionary and, much to his chagrin, was posted to Persia. He didn't know anything about Persia. He was very nervous about having to preach the gospel to Muslims. He had heard all kinds of awful things about the country and the culture. But when he arrived in 1907, he immediately fell in love with the people, the culture, the food especially. He became a very popular teacher at the missionary school. And he spent about a year and a half basically putting his head down and doing what he was told to do. But he had also arrived in the middle of what is now known as the Persian Constitutional Revolution. This was the very first democratic revolution in the Middle East. And it was a bloody affair. And the city that he was assigned to, Tabriz, very quickly became the center of that revolution, the purpose of which was to create a constitution and an elected parliament. In 1909, this battle between the revolutionaries and the Shah of Iran at the time, a man by the name of Muhammad Ali, came to a head. And the city of Tabriz was besieged and its population slowly starved to death. And the horrific scenes that Baskerville saw on the streets activated him and forced him to essentially do something, to, in a way, practice what he was preaching. And so, remarkably, he gave up his missionary post, he gave up his teaching position, and ultimately gave up his American citizenship and joined the revolution. On April 20th of 1909, he and a group of his own students decided, because there was no more food left in the city, that they had no choice but to try to break the siege. In the process of trying to do so, Baskerville was shot in the heart and he ultimately died. But his death galvanized the revolutionaries. They eventually did break the siege. They marched from Tabriz to Tehran and they brought the Shah down. They threw him into exile. They reestablished the constitution. They had new elections for a parliament. And the very first act of that parliament was to declare this 24-year-old Christian missionary from Midwestern America to be a hero and a martyr to the cause of Iranian freedom. He was sort of referred to kind of glibly as Iran's Lafayette. And for most of the last 100 years or so, he has been considered a hero to the cause of Iran.
Yeah, I thought about putting a spoiler alert at the beginning, but I suppose with it being in the title, it's not super necessary.
Yeah, I suppose so.
So you said that this is the best book you've ever written. And, you know, as someone who's read your other books, I'm curious if you can talk about why you feel that way and maybe take us through how putting this book together compared to some of your other books, some of your other work.
Well, it's the most personal book that I've ever written. In many ways, you know, it's quite different because, you know, I'm known for writing these books about religious history. But the truth is that the story of Baskerville is fundamentally the story of someone who is motivated by the oppression and the suffering that he witnesses to put his beliefs into practice and do something about it. Well, that's the story of every prophet who has ever lived. That's the story of Jesus Christ. That's the story of the prophet Muhammad. That's the story of the Buddha. And so in a way, this story is quite familiar to me. It's the kind of story that animates me, that gets me excited. At the same time, of course, it's a story that has profound resonance today. I mean, obviously, we are 4 decades into a very conflicted relationship between the United States and Iran. The animosity between the two governments doesn't need, speaking about. It's quite obvious and has been a huge part of the foreign policies of both countries for decades now. But we're also seeing a country, Iran, right now that is once again under revolutionary turmoil. Once again, we are seeing people pour out onto the streets demanding the same thing that the revolutionaries in Baskerville's time were demanding. And it's not that complicated. What do they want? A say in the decisions that control their lives. That's not asking much. Human dignity, the freedom to choose for themselves, the ability to think and believe what they choose to believe. These are things that we all take for granted. And yet, for more than 100 years, Iranians have been willing to die for it. And it still has not been granted to them. And here is a kid, this American kid, a Christian kid, who 100 years ago died for those very same principles that men and women are dying for right now, as we speak, on the streets of Iran.
No, I absolutely. As I was reading this, I thought it was especially salient that I'd be talking to you now, given the recent events in Iran. And you mentioned how personal this was to you. And I'm curious, you know, because there were a couple moments where you sort of insert yourself or your assessment or your judgment, which, you know, it makes a lot of sense, especially filling in gaps and painting a narrative. But you say things like, you know, I like to imagine him as, or I picture this as. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how your relationship with and your understanding of the history of the events, as well as with Howard Baskerville as a character, as a figure, how that evolved and how that maybe changed as you researched and wrote this book.
Yeah, I mean, as I say very early on in the book, you know, I've always sort of known the basic outlines of this story, the way that, you know, so many Americans maybe Heard about George Washington cutting down the cherry tree somewhere in school. You know, they couldn't tell you where they heard that story, but they've heard it somewhere. And this was kind of the same thing with Howard Baskerville. And so, you know, he kind of existed in my imagination for many, many, many years before I really began to research who he was, what he did, why he did it, and what his actions meant then and what they mean now. This is the very first biography ever written about this kid. And so I really wanted in the feel of the book, which is, you know, historically rigorous and deeply researched, to nevertheless have that sense of discovery to it. It's almost as though you, the reader, are discovering this person at the same time that I'm discovering him. And so I added those little literary flares in there to bring the story alive in a way that sort of a dry biography often cannot. But also, I don't want to lie. I see myself in Baskerville. At least I hope to see myself in Baskerville. I mean, to me, the idea that, as we read in the Epistle of James in the Bible, in the book that Baskerville believed in, where, you know, James says, faith without works is dead. I'm not a Christian, but that verse has long animated me and my activism in the world. And in a way, this kid has become a kind of model for what that truly means, right? What does it really, really mean to put your beliefs into practice? Are you willing to sacrifice yourself for those beliefs? Are you willing to sacrifice yourself for people that you barely know, for a cause that's not yours, a country that you don't belong in, simply because they are human beings and they deserve dignity? I mean, it's funny because nowadays the idea of democracy promotion in the world is mocked. I mean, we barely believe in democracy here in the United States anymore. And yet, here was this kid who was willing, at the age of 24, to die with that fundamental belief that people should be free. And I think it's a model that we really could use right now, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, you mentioned using literary flares to kind of help paint this picture. And for me, the book was so vivid, so rich with sensory detail. I'm thinking of some of the descriptions of the landscapes, the Nord Express, when Tabriz, when Baskerville first arrived, you can just taste the market, you can feel the energy. Can you talk about just the sheer amount of research that went into this book and how you approached it, looking at it from a narrative construction perspective, trying to put together a cohesive narrative with this?
You know, I really appreciate that question, and thank you so much, because I tried very hard to do precisely what you were saying. It's funny, there's not a lot written about Baskerville in English, as you can imagine. There's a translation of a speech that one of his students gave on the 50th anniversary of his death, and that's pretty much it. But I discovered a treasure trove of information, weirdly, in not just in Persian, but also in Russian. The Russian Empire had a huge role to play in supporting the Shah during the Constitutional Revolution. And then at the same time, I discovered in the Presbyterian Historical Archives and in the Princeton University Archives a great deal of information about Baskerville, written by people who were frankly freaking out about what he was trying to do. The State Department, the Presbyterian Church, as you can imagine, the American government, everybody, you know, was trying to figure out, what is this kid doing? How can we stop him? We can't have an American missionary fighting in a foreign revolution. But what I also discovered is letters that Howard Baskerville himself had written to his mother and to the American consul, in which he makes it very clear why he's doing what he's doing. That he's doing it in the name of his Christianity, that he's doing it because he's American, not because he's denying his American identity. And that notion of, you know, a protagonist who undergoes the kind of deep transformation that Howard Baskerville underwent is essentially the archetype of every great story in the world. So once I realized that change, right, the narrative arc, the journey that this young kid went on in these two short years that he was in Iran, then it was very easy to write this in a way that was dramatic and entertaining and appealing. You know, I really wanted this to read like a novel, because his journey has everything that you would want from the best works of fiction, but incredibly, it's all true. And I wanted to feel very much like you were reading not a biography, but a true narrative account of a young man who undergoes a profound transformation when confronted with an intolerable situation.
Well, speaking from my own reading, I would say you succeeded. For me, absolutely, without a doubt, one of the most compelling aspects are just these characters, these people. At some points, it almost reads like a Wild West story. I'm thinking about, forgive my mispronunciation, but I'm thinking about like Colonel Liakov, the commander of the Cossack Brigade, Hassan Sharif Zadeh, the revolutionary, the BFF of Howard Baskerville, Sitar Khan, the people's commander. These are quite
larger than life characters.
That was what I was going to say, larger than life. And I'm curious, from a writer perspective, how do you find a balance between the narrative focus and avoid potentially falling into these fascinating but still rabbit holes when you're with these historical figures? How do you stay on target when you have such fascinating characters going on?
You know, I love the fact that you talk about the rabbit hole, because I turned this book in at, I would say, 50% more pages than it currently is, because I couldn't help myself.
Right.
You know, talking about someone like Vladimir Liakov, the Russian colonel who was sent by the Tsar to essentially put an end to this, to the revolution, or the Shah's Russian tutor, Shapshal Khan, who was unquestionably a double agent. I mean, or you mentioned Hassan Sharif Zadeh, this incredibly young, charismatic, himself son of clerics, just like Baskerville, but who, like Baskerville, gave up the pulpit in order to join this revolution. It is very hard not to delve incredibly deeply into all of these stories. And in fact, there's so many more characters that, were left on the proverbial cutting room floor. In order to kind of, you know, keep this narrative somewhat contained. But one thing that I will say is that if you're the kind of person who enjoys endnotes, boy, do I have some endnotes for you in this book, because I put all of that stuff in the endnotes. So if you're fascinated about the history of, you know, rail travel in 1907, or, you know, the many, many lives that Colonel Liakov ended up living, or who Shapshal Khan actually was, this Russian agent / Russian tutor to the Shah, who was getting the equivalent of $200,000 a year to teach the Shah Russian. And after a decade of doing so, the Shah couldn't speak two words of Russian. It's too good. There's too many good stories. And I really had to kind of cull everything down to create, you know, the focus that the book has to keep the narrative driven.
Yeah, I would say the endnotes themselves, in and of themselves, are essentially a resource, an educational resource. You went through unpublished memoirs, all these photographs that you were able to put together. Just the story as a narrative is compelling, but there's also just the actual database at the end. kind of nearing the end here. At the beginning of this book, and you've touched on this a little bit so far, but you talk about how in Iran, Baskerville was referred to as simply the American. You made reference to, you know, Lafayette, and America itself as at one point essentially being viewed as a nation of Baskervilles. How has that view changed, and what does it look like today, especially in light of recent events, you know, literally current events right now?
Yeah. I think what surprises a lot of Americans is that while it is true that the Iranian government is profoundly anti-American, in fact, it's basically the prevailing ideology in Iran is not Islam, it's anti-Americanism. And that while the population itself is no fan of the American government and the pernicious influence it has had on Iranian politics and Iranian society, the Iranian people themselves have nothing but love for the American people. Any American who has ever visited Iran will tell you this exact same story, that the Iranian people love Americans, American culture, American film, American pop culture and music. They just love everything about America. And they have the ability to differentiate between the American people and the American government in a way that Americans, for some reason, seem not to have that ability. And so when we're looking at the protests that are taking place right now, I think sometimes we feel ourselves, well, what can we do? How can we help? And there's certainly things that the American government, that the Biden administration can do, for instance, easing sanctions when it comes to communications, telecommunications, internet, etc., allow Iranians to actually access the rest of the world. But at the same time, there are things that Americans can do too. And I know that, you know, quote unquote, slacktivism or like social media activism gets a real bad rap because, you know, people say, well, you're not really doing anything. You're just tweeting about it. But if you only knew how important that was to that 18-year-old Iranian woman risking her life for the most basic rights in Iran, to know that there are millions of Americans who are listening, who are watching, who sympathize and who support and maybe can't do anything, you know, except understand and love and preach a different version of what Iranians are, who they actually are, than they hear from their own American government. But you have no idea how valuable and important that is. Yeah, I talk about the fact that maybe one day we can all once again become a nation of Baskervilles. I think that's what it means. Baskerville was able to ignore the rhetoric of his own government and the rhetoric of the Iranian government and focus on the needs of the people. And in his case, he was willing to sacrifice himself for those needs. We don't need to sacrifice ourselves, but at the very least, we need to understand and empathize with those needs and work as hard as we can to make sure that the people who make the decisions in our government are actually making decisions that service the needs of the Iranian people. Right now, that's not happening.
Well said. Agreed. Be sure to stop by and see Reza Aslan at the Miami Book Fair from November 13th to 20th in beautiful Miami, Florida, and pick up a copy of his latest book, An American Martyr in Persia, The Epic Life and Tragic Death of Howard Baskerville, which comes out in October and is now available for pre-order. Reza Aslan, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Drew. Appreciate it.